Alice. I have the great pleasure to co-creating the Discourse program of Elevate Festival together with Florian Pirke and the team, and hosting this first session of today. And what is also something I wanted to say, a warm welcome to the people tuning in via the live stream, which was the reason why it took us a bit to turn on today. And also hello to our friends at Radio Helsinki, who are broadcasting the entire Discourse program. And what is also something of great value to many of us, we have this Elevate Media channel, our archive. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And we're broadcasting not only, but we're recording all of those sessions. This means if you miss anything today, if you want to revisit some of the content, you can always, I think from tomorrow onwards, go back to our website, find all the talks of the last years, but of course, today's as well. So now to today's and our theme of the festival in general, trust issues. So we wanted to invite us all to explore those trust issues, all those questions of our time. Where does trust come from? How is it broken? How can it be rebuilt, if so? But what we also see, that trust is often framed only in human terms. So it's about trust or mistrust in institutions, in politics, in media and technology, and of course, a very important part, trust in each other, in yourself. But trust is more than a social contract. Trust is definitely more than a rational calculation, like in contracts, there's also the question of trust. And what we certainly believe, and which was also something that was even more inspired by reading James Bridle's most current book, Ways of Being, is that trust probably is more than meets the eye. And this brings us directly to our star of our speaker of today, James Bridle. A few words of accolade to James. He's one of the most exciting and thought-provoking voices when it comes to rethinking our relationship with technology and intelligence, with nature. As an artist, writer, and technologist, they have been shaping the discourse on digital culture for years, contributing to leading media outlets such as The Guardian, Wired, and The Atlantic, and of course his books, the recent one available here to buy. And their award-winning works address some of the most urgent issues of our time. From the exploration and exploitation of migration policies to the erosion of privacy by corporate power, and now, most recently, the exploration of what is intelligence, where do we oversee intelligent life forms, where are all those solutions that are out there, those tapas, there are plenty of alternatives that we might be overlooking. So in their latest book, Ways of Being, Bridle expands the conversation on intelligence far beyond the human realm. They explore the astonishing diversity of non-human intelligent, animal, plant, fungi, artificial, and challenge us to imagine new ways of relating, collaborating, co-creating with them. But the festival started on Wednesday, so for me it's a bit of a mix, I have to say. Ways will take you on a journey that might fundamentally, be prepared, reshape how we think about trust, intelligence, and the very systems we live in. So please join me in welcoming James Bridle.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you for that lovely welcome. Thank you for permitting me to speak remotely, which I really appreciate. I know it's not always the ideal way, and I'd love to be there with you. I've been to Elevate before and had a really wonderful time, so I hope this year's edition is as exciting as they have been previously. I'm going to talk a little bit today about intelligence, relationships, and only really very, very little about trust, but I'm hoping maybe it will build into something around that. For those who aren't familiar with some of the things I'm going to talk about, I want to start with intelligence. And I want to start by talking about how we might reconsider intelligence and how, in fact, intelligence has been reconsidered by many thinkers and scientists. I set out a few years ago now to write a book about intelligence. And I thought it would really be about how minds worked internally, like what happens inside our heads, inside machines, perhaps in the heads of other beings as well. And I realized very quickly that our idea of intelligence, as we commonly speak of it, and as really as we're kind of told to think about it, particularly when it comes to things like artificial intelligence or intelligence tests, IQ tests, those kind of things, it's really this deep focus on what's inside the head. And it turns out that's a really terrible way of thinking about intelligence. Because really, as soon as you start to explore what it means to be intelligent in the world, how intelligence actually functions, what it does, you start to see intelligence as more of a process, as a relationship, as something that emerges when things meet, rather than something that happens entirely internally. And I really want to talk particularly about one of those aspects for a little while, which is the embodiedness of intelligence. Intelligence is something that happens as a result of the bodies we have, not just of what goes on inside our skulls. And a really good example of to give you an idea of what I mean by an embodied intelligence is to introduce my friend here, the gibbon. Gibbons are really wonderful creatures, and like many of the apes who are close, kind of genetically and evolutionarily to us, they've been heavily studied to kind of see what we can understand about their behaviour, and therefore maybe something about us or about our relationships. And for a long time, gibbons really stood out in these studies, and because they seem to behave very differently to a lot of the other, what I've referred to with a word I don't usually like, higher apes, i.e. the ones that are closest to us, because we think of ourselves, obviously, as the highest. They didn't perform quite the same way in some of these tests as the other ones. There's, for example, a very common test, which is supposed to show the intelligence of creatures, which is tool use. Can they use objects in order to achieve goals? And so, you know, a common kind of test of this is that you have a subject inside an enclosure. There's some kind of treat just out of reach, and there's a, you know, a stick or some kind of lure with which to get to the treat. And, you know, you give a human a stick, and even a small child, and across most cultures, a tool like this, you know, you'll grab for the stick. You give it to a gorilla or a chimpanzee or an orangutan. Boom, boom, boom. But for years, the gibbons just like totally refused to participate in this. They would just like stare at the stick. They're not really interested. Look at the snack, look hungry, but not interact in this way. And so for a long time, according to this kind of way of thinking about intelligence that we had through the experimental apparatus that we devised, gibbons were seen as less intelligent. They just didn't measure up to the other apes, including us. Until 20 years into these kind of experiments, someone redesigned this experiment. And what they did was they hung the grabbing sticks from the ceiling of the gibbons enclosure. And immediately, within minutes, the gibbons went, oh, grab the stick, grab the snack. Great. In that moment, gibbons suddenly like became intelligent. Of course, they'd been intelligent all along. We'd just been unable to see it. And one of the reasons perhaps for that is that gibbons are brachiators, which means they spend most of their time living in the trees, unlike a lot of other apes close to us who are mostly ground walking, or at least spend a lot of time on the ground. Gibbons spend almost their entire time in a completely different three-dimensional, vertically oriented environment. And that means, it seems, that their intelligence is also vertically oriented. They look up, they look around themselves in a different way to other apes. Because of their experience, because of their body pattern, because of the kind of limbs they have these very long fingers, which are much better adapted to grasping onto things, makes it actually quite hard for them to pick things up off the ground. And so as soon as we understood and changed our way of intelligence to adapt to this different embodiment, immediately we saw all the extraordinary potential of the gibbon. It suddenly, as I say, became intelligent according to our definition of what intelligence is. But it's, of course, our expectations of how that intelligence manifests in relationship to the world that actually shifts our awareness of what intelligence is. And when you start to see intelligence as something that emerges out of embodiment, out of the environment, out of relations with the things around us, then we start to see intelligence in all these kind of different ways. You've probably heard a lot in the last few years about octopuses. They've become the kind of charismatic example of non-human intelligence for really good reason. Like, they're excellent at solving puzzles. You know, they're famed for being really good at escaping from tanks and zoos. they can recognize individual humans, which is quite impressive because humans can't really recognize individual octopuses very well. They have favorites and preferences. They like some people, they dislike others. There's stories of labs where they will squirt water at the people they don't like. And they've learned even how to squirt water at light bulbs to turn off the lights in their tank if they're bothered, these kind of things. So they have a well-deserved reputation for intelligence. And it's easy to forget while wondering at how extraordinary they are, just quite how vastly different to ours that intelligence must be. Right? These are beings that live and have evolved for millions of years in a radically different environment, with a radically different body plan, this, you know, eight legs, with a radically different brain structure. Octopus brains are spread all the way through their bodies. They have neurons all the way down through their arms, which seems to suggest that the arms are actually capable of almost independent operation, that rather than having a single centralized brain like us, they have this kind of federated mind of different things happening in different places at different times with a kind of distributed intention and attention. So they're extraordinary creatures. And yeah, they do all these things that we recognize as being intelligent. And so from that strangeness and yet recognition of intelligence, again, we understand that intelligence must exist so radically differently and have come to be so differently. Because of course, even though octopuses are so different from us environmentally and have evolved under such different conditions for such a long time, we are connected. 14 million years ago, there was some kind of small blind worm that lived on the bottom of the ocean, from which both we and the octopus evolved, right? 14 million years that way and 14 million years back up the other side, separated in fact by 28 million years of evolution. And yet not only the mind, but there's other strange similarities with us and the octopus. The octopus eye, for example, is very similar to the mammalian eye, right? It's a kind of gel-filled sac with a pupil, with rods and cones and this kind of stuff. In fact, it has one superiority. Its optic nerve connects in a different way, so it doesn't have the blind spot that mammals have. But otherwise, it's a very similar thing. And yet, we both come from that blind flatworm. So we don't share the same eye. The eye evolved separately twice, right? And in fact, the eyes have evolved in multiple species in multiple ways over time. It's something, it's convergent evolution. It's the fact that many different pathways have been found to this one particular solution for sensing light and for sensing other things as well. And the point about that is to say, if the eye has evolved once, then so has intelligence. Intelligence has evolved in all these different ways. And what we tend to think of as a kind of hierarchy of intelligence, just as we tend to think of hierarchies of everything else, is really a kind of spreading tree, a network, a net, or a cloud, in which intelligence has flowered all over the place in all of these extraordinary ways. And some of these, you know, are really so extraordinarily far from us as to be really deeply unimaginable. This is a slime mold. Slime molds are very strange creatures somewhere between algae and fungi that that live on dead wood on the forest floor. They're composed of sometimes of millions and millions of individual cells, which sometimes act autonomously, and sometimes they come together to form these kind of fruiting bodies, some of them sacrificing them for the good of the others. They do a whole bunch of things that make them very, very hard to categorize within our neat arrangement of organisms. One of the things they do particularly well is that they're very efficient at finding ways of gathering food to make the most efficient and shortest connections between places. And this is something that humans are very interested in as well. And it's been discovered that slime molds are very, very good at solving these kind of problems of efficiency that both humans and many of our computers are very interested in as well. There's a thing in mathematics called the traveling salesman problem that goes back hundreds of years ago to what was originally called the Bridges of Königsberg problem, which simply says, like, given a list of places, given, you know, six cities, for example, what is the shortest distance to visit each one of them once? And that turns out to be an incredibly hard problem because there's no easy way to fix it. You just have to measure all the possibilities. And the thing is, for six cities, there's 6 × 5 × 4 × 3 × 2 × 1 different possible solutions, and you just have to measure them all. There's no shortcut to doing that. So this is a computationally hard problem. particularly because as soon as you start adding more cities, the problem gets exponentially harder, because then it becomes 7 × 6 × 5 × 4 × 3 × 2 × 1 8 × 7 × 6 and so on and so forth. And the graph of solving that problem goes like this. It goes vroom, vertically up towards the sky. Now, exponential problems are the kind of problems that people and machines absolutely hate, because of this problem of them getting harder and harder and harder as you add things and taking longer and longer to solve. When scientists set slime molds this problem, they discovered that slime molds don't have this problem. Slime molds are capable of solving this problem in linear time. They find the most efficient solution to this problem in a manner that doesn't increase in time over time. The graph goes up, but not towards the ceiling, in linear time rather than exponential time. And this is extraordinary because it's not something that we know how to do. They do better than us. And they also do better than all the most powerful computers we've ever built. And, you know, they're probably not even trying to do it as such. Like, this is just a thing that they do. And they're probably doing all kinds of amazing other things that we have no particular access to. This is just like, a bit like the Gibbons, a test that we've set them and they've somehow managed to ace. And again, we don't have access to, we can start to figure out some of the science of how they're starting to do this, but like what the slime mold makes of doing this and how this came to be is something that will always be beyond this. And this idea that there are forms of intelligence in the world that are doing extraordinarily intelligent things and yet we do not really have access to is one that I find fascinating and one that I will loop back later on perhaps to this question of trust. If that all sounds a bit abstract, then we can narrow a little bit of these questions of intelligence and also the extraordinary abilities of other beings down to like maybe particular behaviors. And one thing I've used to think about this a lot is the question of senses, like the real interactions that we have through our senses with the world around us. Because you'll find, and as I've found, that actually we live in this incredibly multi-sensory world that far extends beyond like what we're aware of occurring at all times. One of the most extraordinary results for me of biology in the last decade or so is the discovery that plants hear. So there was an experiment that was done a few years ago that was kind of the groundbreaking one of this, where the researchers placed caterpillars on the leaves of a cabbage plant. And they recorded, using very powerful tiny microphones, the sound of the caterpillars munching on the leaves. And then they took the caterpillars away and they brought out another plant and they played the plant through speakers the sound of the caterpillars munching. And immediately the plants flooded their leaves with chemical defenses as a reaction to predation from caterpillars, even though there were no caterpillars present. They played them other sounds, the sound of the wind, knocking sounds, whatever it was. They didn't have this response. They responded very specifically to the sound of the caterpillars munching. And we don't know, again, how they do this. There's a bunch of structures within the plants that may be responsible for this, but really don't understand how they're doing it. That simply we have to understand that we live in a world in which all the beings around us are sensing and sharing in this world around us. And that's what strikes me as being extraordinary, that there is an ongoing relationship, an ongoing communication through the sensory world of all the beings around us. And that expands as soon as you start to look at it. These are evening primrose flowers. They grow on sandy beaches, sandy soils, and they open their flowers at night for particular pollinators, primarily for moths. Moths as well as bees are frequent pollinators, and in evening primroses like these are frequently pollinated by moths. So they open up their flowers at night, and it turns out that the flower is not just an aesthetic object. It's not just a thing to be seen. The flower is a sensor. The flower is a sound receiver. And when the moth flies nearby, the specific frequency of the flower's pollinator causes it to release more nectar. The flower hears the bee. There's a mutual relationship of vision and sound and communication occurring between these organisms. And what I start to think about is I start to think about the many, many worlds of the senses that surround us at all times, many of which we're not even aware of, right? We don't know what sounds the plants are attuned to. We don't know what sounds they hear, and they likely have no access to the many of the sounds that we hear and that make meaningful to us, but they have a world, right? They are creating a world out of their senses, and some of those worlds overlap and some of them are completely distinct, but they form a world of many worlds and ultimately a world that we do all share, because we are all subject to the same vibrations, the same solar radiation, the same light and sounds that are occurring to all of us. To bring that back to intelligence, there's extraordinary work done by a researcher called Monica Galliano. And what Galliano does is she works with these plants, mimosa plants. Mimosas are very interesting and useful and helpful experimental colleagues because they're one of the few plants that move in human time, let's say. It's hard to watch a tree growing. It's hard to catch it in the act. But mimosa plants, when you touch them, they curl their leaves up very quickly, whoom, like that. So they have this like immediate response. It's very visible. And so Galliano worked with this and with these plants to show something incredibly extraordinary, which is that she put these plants in little pots on a little rail and she dropped them like this onto a little pad, not far enough to like damage the plant in any way, but far enough just to trigger this response and the leaves would curl up. And what she found was that she did this a few times. And after a little while, the plants stopped curling up. They stopped reacting to this. She did other things. She poked them. They'd curl up, you know, blow on them with a strong wind. They'd curl up. But the drop, they didn't curl up. They'd learned that this particular stimulus, this particular shock was not harmful to them. And so they'd adapted and changed their behavior in response. She tested the same plants months and months later. She found the plants that hadn't been dropped before curled up, but the ones that had learned before remembered. So plants learn and remember. They have a behavior and they change it. And this is deeply extraordinary as well, not least again, because we don't know what the mechanisms for doing this are. There is an intelligence at work here to which we have no access. And I'm going to keep coming back to that question of like, how do we understand this and what form we understand it? Because so much of our way of accessing the world is really a form of domination, right? It's a kind of extraction of an understanding of the world in order to recreate it in certain ways. And that's not possible here because we don't have this understanding. And that comes out in Galliano's research, the researcher who did this work with the mimosas, because interestingly, she has a background not in botany, but in animal behavior. She studied fish on the Great Barrier Reef before she moved on to plants. And when she writes about this, she says the fact is that, you know, historically within botany and botanical sciences, plants were regarded as essentially machines, as robotic creatures, essentially a set of moving parts, and you could cut them up into all their little pieces and study all those little pieces, and you know, understand how each little bit worked and then put them together. But because she had a background in animal behaviors, she instead treated them as whole organisms, really as individuals, and saw them as beings with behaviors. And that shift in perspective from a kind of machinic view of the world to a view of individuals, of organisms, of creatures with behaviors, of beings, allowed her to see this behavior. The other interesting thing about her work is that Galliano is very outspoken about having what she calls a shamanic practice, which means that as well as doing her scientific work, she also spends time communicating with plant spirits. And in fact, some of the plant spirits she has been in contact with have helped her design her experiments. She talks about co-designing these experiments with the plants themselves, very movingly so. And you can understand, or you may expect, that this annoys some scientists. If you exist within this entirely rational worldview of an experimental and so-called rational mindset, then the idea that the plants might design the experiment might annoy you. What's wonderful about this is that it doesn't matter because Galliano designed the experiments within the framework of the scientific method, reproducible experiments, peer-reviewed journals, all this kind of stuff. So that if you don't care about the idea of plant spirits, or you don't think that maybe the idea of an intelligence necessariness, would extend to anything resembling consciousness or beinghood, it doesn't matter because all we know about the ability of plants to learn, to adapt and remember still is valid within the scientific framework. But for me, what Galliano's work shows is that it's possible to have these different lenses on the world, that both are valid, that in fact, that perhaps putting them together could make them even more interesting and valid, that you can choose how to see the world. It reminds us that they're all just different epistemologies, all different ways of describing, categorizing the world based on our own experiences. None is more valid than any other way of understanding. Each one has its own thing to teach us, but they are things that we can use productively when they are useful and step outside them and think otherwise about the world when they are less useful. I could talk really quite endlessly about the extraordinary capabilities of plants alone, but, you know, before we even get into fungi or other animal species, all kinds of stuff. But I want to talk about these ones in particular, because this for me is one we're really learning from. This is a field in northern Greece. I live in Greece, and I worked for a little while with the scientists up there, who are experimenting with a set of plants called hyperaccumulators. Hyperaccumulators are a particular class of plants, all kinds of different plants. It's a quality of certain kinds of plants. That means they accumulate metals from the soil, usually metals, some other substances as well. They hyperaccumulate them, just means they're really good at doing that. What's interesting about most of these hyperaccumulators is that they live in soils which are toxic to other plant life because they're so full of some particular contaminant. Perhaps naturally, it's not necessarily humans that have done this, though this is being used, for example, on decontaminating or mining sites. But here in northern Greece, in the mountains of Epirus, the soil is very naturally rich in nickel, which makes it quite poor for growing other crops. But these particular plants, there's actually three being grown on this site, are hyperaccumulators of nickel. And what that means is that they can grow in these nickel-rich soils. They draw the nickel up from the soil into their leaves and stalks, and they store it there. As they do so, they remediate the ground. They make the ground less nickel-rich, making it more suitable for other crops. And it also means that we can harvest them. This is called phytomining. It's where you plant hyperaccumulators, you harvest them twice a year. The roots stay in place, sequestering carbon and continuing the life of the plant. Meanwhile, you can harvest the top of the plant and you can get that nickel out of it. You can harvest metal, growing it out of the ground. And there's experiments about this kind of all over the world. And it's, for me, a really extraordinary example of something where, you know, humans have spent millennia working out how to acquire metals, in this case, through these incredibly violent extractive processes that damage and further poison the ground. Whereas these plants have figured out how to do exactly the same thing, to draw this out of the ground in a regenerative way, in a way that improves the health of the ground without damaging it and still makes it accessible to us. We're never, to be clear, going to be able to replace our current mineral needs with this kind of process. But then our current needs are too high anyway. And we have so much to learn from these kind of processes that are already occurring out in the world when we go out to look for them. And what's particularly about this for me as well is that, you know, these are adaptive evolutionary processes in place. Place, locality, and embodiment matters. There's three plants that are being grown here. There's an amaryllis and two born morellas. The amaryllis grows all around the Mediterranean basin. There's similar experiments going on with it in France and other places. Then there's a thing called Bornuella emarginata, which grows all around the Balkans and a little bit around the north of the Adriatic. And then also on this site, there's a third plant called Bornuella timfea. Now, Bornuella timfea is named for Mount Timphi, which is the mountain just 10 kilometers from this site. And timfea only grows within a 40 kilometer radius of this place. And when they measured the different amounts of nickel that were being drawn up by each plant, they discovered that, and perhaps unsurprisingly, Bornuella timfea was the most extractive nickel, efficient nickel extractor in this particular location. Because these plants have a knowledge of the place that they're in, that they've been learning about through evolution for as long as any of us have been around. And by any of us, I mean all species. And so, of course, in each particular place, we find the knowledges that are suited to it, embodied by the beings that live there. I like to think about the kind of senses that we have to access the world, what we can do with them, because we live within such a narrow slice of space and time. And we perceive such a narrow slice of space and time. You know, we only perceive a very narrow range of electromagnetic frequencies as light, for example. We perceive a few others as like heat on our skin, that kind of thing. But really, like the spectrum of the rainbow, what we call the visible spectrum, is only our visible spectrum. Other beings perceive a far wider range of visual colors for us, of course. And then, of course, there's smell and there's hearing, neither of which humans are particularly good at with respect to other creatures. So we live within this very narrow range of senses, given not just the whole total possibility, but what other beings are capable of perceiving as well. And of course, then there's other ways of perceiving. I was astonished to learn recently that echolocation, while we usually associate it with bats and with cetaceans and some other fish, is also, it's possible to learn. This is something that I was looking for, an example of something that, well, would seem so strange to us and unimaginable, this idea that you could use sound to create a picture in the mind, which is essentially what echolocation is. And I thought it was only available to certain species. It turns out it's available to us as well, and that many people with a poor or no sight at all have taught themselves to do echolocation. If you look online, you can find interviews with people, blind people riding bicycles through traffic and this kind of stuff, because they've taught themselves a sense. I was looking for an example of something that spoke to a difference, and once again I found an example of something that actually spoke to our capability of learning and seeing more about the world. And of course, because we are capable of, if not experiencing those things directly, at least of making them sensible to us, is the appropriate word, sensible. And of course, we do this all the time through technologies, primarily. If you've ever seen satellite imagery, for example, really, it's not so obvious, but it's in fact happening in the digital photos on your phone, when you do like this kind of extra wide aperture or high dimensional visioning and stuff like this. But and in really high class scientific imaging, like satellite imaging, we're opening our vision up to huge ranges of frequencies that the human eye is not able to perceive, and yet gives us this extraordinary view on the world. This, for example, is a satellite image, a false color satellite image of islands in Southeast Asia, which to the human eye are not red. To the human eye, they're all shades of green. But because the camera on the satellite is capable of picking up frequencies of light which do not which are not registered by the human eye, it can see more about the world than we are capable of doing it. So the reds in this image correspond to the essentially the health of plant life. That there's certain frequencies that are reflected from plants that we do not perceive, but which, if you can perceive them, tell you how healthy that plant is through the amount of water in it, the amount of chlorophyll, the amount of active photosynthesis that's going on. And so through the use of these kind of mechanical prostheses, we actually are capable of expanding our view of this world in certain ways. We are capable of seeing more. We can see through a wider array of spectra. And of course, we can see through time as well. I said we live within a narrow slice of space and time. Well, we live within a, you know, the lifespan of our days, our months, our years, and of course our lifespans, which, you know, again, compared to many other species, and certainly according to the Earth itself, it's a very narrow slice. And yet one of the things that technology does amazingly well is to create these vast archives of imagery that allow us to perceive the world in radically different ways. This is, of course, the shrinking of the Aral Sea over decades caused by human activity seen from space, that we're capable of seeing because we've been collecting this kind of imagery and storing it and making it accessible for such a long, long time. So technology allows us to see through space in new ways, also to see through time in new ways. Of course, we do have the technologies to see and speak through time. And I don't want to suggest that this is a purely technological thing. If you've lived alongside the Aral Sea, perhaps for generations, then you and your people and your culture will have stories about the shrinking of the sea. We do have modes of making culture, non-technological ones, that extend through time. But to make them, render them visible in this way, to make them shareable, is something that we often turn to technology for. So given that we can imagine this extra sensory, I was always called a meta-sensory world, in which all these different capabilities cooperate, then how do we start to put them together in interesting ways, right? Because I began this by talking about, of course, ourselves and all other beings as really a kind of a network of different ways of perceiving and understanding the world rather than a hierarchy. Can we take that connection further and start to put those different senses together to do really interesting, extraordinary things? Well, one of my favorite examples of that is the goats of Laukeela. A few years ago, some researchers from one of the Max Planck Institutes in Germany, they put little accelerometers, very simple little systems on a bunch of different animals, in fact, on cows, goats, sheep, dogs, in a couple of sites in Italy, one around Mount Etna on Sicily, and one in the town of L'Aquila, a very earthquake-prone region of central Italy. Those tags, little radio frequency tags, very low powered, were connected to a satellite on the International Space Station, right? So you've suddenly connected a bunch of farm animals up to this vast technological apparatus that we all live inside. This network of kind of almost unimaginable scope. And what they found was that when they started studying the data, which is essentially just the motion data, how much these creatures moved around, they discovered that they moved around more ahead of earthquakes, that they could actually use the activity patterns of various animals to predict earthquakes hours, sometimes even days ahead of any other method we've developed. And this is extraordinary because this is a very useful, critically important thing to be able to do. You can save lives, probably some money as well, by having good earthquake prediction. And it's something that we haven't been able to develop ourselves to anything like the effectiveness that clearly animals are capable of sensing, various animals are capable of sensing. And there's a bunch of stuff that's really fascinating about that. This is something, of course, that's been attested by folk wisdom for a long time. The stories going back in many cultures of animals kind of acting weird before earthquakes occur. But that's never been, we've never been able to do any kind of prediction based on that. But this turns out to be a really solid, predictable system. Like, we really can build earthquakes alarms out of this stuff in a way that just having the stories about it doesn't always make possible. And the other thing that's extraordinary about it is that the activity data, this kind of, you know, reams of information that's flowing off these animals up to the International Space Station and down to a computer somewhere, is not really immediately human readable. It's very complex, messy, noisy data. And so in order to analyze it, the scientists had to use machine learning. And they, in fact, they turned to machine learning algorithms that were originally developed for spotting patterns within financial transactions for the stock exchange, for making money on the stock exchange. You know, the most aggressive predatory algorithms you can imagine. And I really love this idea of these kind of capitalist algorithms retiring from the city and going off to the countryside to kind of do better, more ecological work and kind of keep us safe rather than just purely generating money elsewhere. These are clams, which also do a similar useful function to ones the goats might do, within the water systems of Poland. This is in the city of Poznan, I think, but I think they're in a few places. Clams help to keep the water system safe. And the way that they do this is that clams are incredibly, incredibly sensitive to impurities in water. Again, far, far more sensitive to water impurities than any sensor, any technological sensor, let alone humans ourselves, that we've developed. And so what the water engineers in Poland did was they have, in the mains water distribution centers, they have beds of these clams, with little wires attached to them that monitor when the clams stay open and when the clams close, because the clams detect even the tiniest impurity, the tiniest bit of toxicity in that water, they close immediately. And when that happens, they immediately shut off the water supply. So they make sure no, any kind of tainting or whatever doesn't get out to the population. And this happens, as I say, far faster than any other sensor we've developed. So we've harnessed this extraordinary ability of the clams to make ourselves safe. And the reason I mentioned them and the goats last is really because I want to take it back to you know, what I was saying about the plants, their intelligence, and our ability to access them. Our ability to understand exactly what is going on. Now, we understand a fair bit about how clams maybe sense impurities in water. We have no idea at all how animals sense incoming earthquakes. It may be some change in electrical charges in the atmosphere. It might be some kind of, it's not micro tremors because our seismographers don't detect them. There's something else going on there. We don't have access to them. And really that's my point for starting to think about trust. Because if we are to live more harmoniously in this world that we share with all of these other worlds, knowing that in the present moment we are not doing so, that the collapse of global ecological systems and so much else is a result of our inability to live in full kind of mutuality with all the other beings around us. Knowing that the only way that we are going to survive, not only as humans, but as a complete global ecosystem into the future, is to build these better relationships, then the forms of understanding the world that we've built the last few hundred years on are going to have to change. This way of knowing the world, the scientific way of knowing the world, and the engineering way of doing it, and so many others that depend on this kind of domination, like the cutting up of plants into tiny, tiny pieces in order to take them apart so that we can kind of extract from them, is mirrored in the way that we treat the earth itself, cutting it up and pulling bits out of it and burning them for our own use. That kind of extractivist dominating knowledge is what has got us into this place in the first place, got us into this position in the first place. And what we need to put in place of it is essentially a kind of trust, is the awareness and understanding and generosity of belief in the capabilities of others, of each other and of non-humans, of the extraordinary capabilities that each of us possess differently, us and all other beings, that we can ever fully know in the way that science and Western rationality wants to construct. We can never know the world in that way, right? But we can cooperate, we can work together. And the conditions for that working together, the conditions for that cooperation are trust. And trust is only possible under conditions of mutual flourishing, when we build a world in which we all cooperate because we all benefit from it. And so within that is a moral imperative to increase the possibilities for flourishing, the life ways, the possibilities for life and joy and everything else of all other beings alongside ourselves, so that trust can be born, so that we can work in trust together to create better worlds. Thank you very much.
I hope you heard some of this warm applause in Greece. James, did you? Thank you very much for your inspiration and what I believe was really an invitation to love the world somehow much more than we could before. Because I think what you just showed us, all those many examples in a time of when intelligence is so oftentimes being reduced to what is human intelligence versus technological capabilities, especially since the introduction of generative AI, large language models such as ChatGPT. I at least for the last 2.5 years, there was even more narrowing down of the concept of what is intelligence, and especially the body was being left out even more than before. So what you do is not only inviting us to extend to the human body, but to our planetary body, the idea of intelligence. And I think this is really something that is inspiring to love the world even more. It's, I think, at least this is how I understand your work, also an invitation to care more about what is going on around us. I think this is really a sublime call for more ecological, safe and sane approaches to how we live together on this planet, to respect, to acknowledge what there is, what we are overseeing, what we're maybe not understanding. And I think this work is so valuable in also giving us some hope again. So this whole question, trust is also related to hope, it's related to action, that there is even more, not only to the eye, more to trust, to intelligence than we see, but there are many more solutions to the problems we're facing, and we're probably overlooking so much of the potential. And you just gave us many, many examples of those overlooked potentials, but not in a way to exploit, but really, again, to give more respect to what is actually happening around us. At least this is how I think your work is bringing not only thought-provoking but love-provoking changes to this world. And yes, still, today I'm not only talking, and it's not only you, but we want to invite the audience. And maybe there is somebody gathering already some questions, some ideas. We have a microphone, and it's already with you.
I found the example of the caterpillars munching with the plants, the whole sound aspect of it, very interesting. Do you have any more examples of studies that involve the sounds of nature? I just found that example just fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to follow up on that. Oh, sorry, can you cut my sound coming to me? Because it confuses me. There's a whole field called... Sorry, I get the feedback into my ears and my brain stops speaking. There's a whole field called bioacoustics, which is really extraordinary, in which there's all kinds of research going on into these sounds that we just weren't really aware of. A couple of recent examples I remember is that actually there's seeds, when they're growing, produce sounds. We don't know their functions. But basically scientists have just started to listen to a whole bunch of stuff that we haven't listened to before. So I was reading a thing about seed kernel, corn kernels, and the way in which they seem to sort of crackle as they grow. And this sound has some kind of function, but we're not even sure what it is yet. Or they've shown that plant rootlets, as they grow into the ground, they move towards sound. So see. Plant roots sense sound in some way. They did this by putting tubes of water running under the ground, and the seeds grew towards the sound of the water. You can use sound to hear the health of trees. If trees dry out, it's quite an obvious one, but it's still quite amazing to me that as trees dry out, as they starve for water, they emit sound. There's a sound to that, and we can use that to pay more attention and to interact better with plants and trees. So that there's a whole field of this kind of growing now called bioacoustics, and probably other terms as well, that's incredibly fascinating.
Thank you. Other questions, other microphones that should be running around. Otherwise, gather your thoughts. I'm sure there will be one more. I can take this opportunity. I would have one question. So again, expanding a bit on trust beyond the human. And from your work, we see that you explore how intelligence manifests across different systems, biological, technological, all the beautiful example you just gave us. But what do you think, what do you count as the biggest barriers for us humans to acknowledge all of this knowledge that is around? I know in your book and the examples you just showed, there are scientists working on these questions since decades even, but it's not really in our conversation. It's certainly not being introduced that, look at where the solutions are lying around maybe. So what do you think? Why don't we trust these approaches more?
I mean, a couple of things, one of which is that it's a very easy job being for someone who reads scientific papers and then tells people about amazing stuff going on, because it takes such a long time for this stuff to filter through. I mean, we're still living, most of us, in a totally Newtonian concept of the world, even though it's over 100 and whatever years since Einstein revealed the actual quantum nature of everything. Some things are really hard to get our heads around. So why is it so hard to get our heads around? I mean, the answer essentially is culture. We and by the way, I mean everyone in this room and sort of Europe and within what we call the West, we have been acculturated into a world in which non-humans are largely silent, that they're dumb, that they're mechanistic. This has been the main view of the West for hundreds of years now. And it's reinforced every day by our everyday culture, by our politics, by our society. It's something that's incredibly hard to break out of. You know, even I talked about Monica Galeano's work and this, you know, this thing about the experimental design on the one hand and the shamanic research on the other. And even I, who like spend time in both these cultures and think about them a lot, even I like feel that like split brain that doesn't want to put those ideas together. And that's a result of acculturation. It's the result of my education, it's my upbringing, and the whole society around that makes it very hard to think. At the same time, this stuff is accessible. Like if you can go now and sit beneath a tree and close your eyes and listen and be in touch. We haven't lost this ability. The words that arise within you when giving close attention to non-humans is the non-human world speaking to you. We are entirely connected with this at all times. We're just distracted and inattentive and part of our cultures. And it sometimes feels hard, but it's right there waiting for us all time and desperate to speak to us.
Thank you. So listen to this language of, I keep to this love thing. Is there another question? Otherwise we could probably also close the session, but no hands. James, would you have a final remark to us, being on this journey without you, unfortunately, but on this discovery of trust issues, but on the other hand, mapping ways to design trust. For instance, this morning we had a beautiful session with students. And of course, it's not only about talking, it's about dancing, it's about letting ourselves immerse in music. Maybe you have a final, I don't know, word of wisdom for us to share.
I would say that sounds wonderful. I think, you know, one thing I've learned coming, you know, myself from a deeply technological background and all the other backgrounds I've just spoken of, is that embodiment really matters. We, despite all of our technological wonders and everything else, we are still embodied in these flashy carapaces. Our fingers and our hands are just the size they are, and they're what we have to touch the world with. And so any understanding of the world has to emerge from our direct relationship with it in this way. And as I just said about this kind of more than human thinking, we have that capabilities at all times. And if the first thing to trust in is one's body and oneself, that one's experiences are real, and that one what one wishes and desires for the world is real and matters. And from that, all other forms of trust may blossom.
Much. So this is very much in the spirit of a festival that combines body and brain, dance and discourse. And I think, embodiment matters and trust does, and intelligence is much more than we probably think of most of the time. James Bridle, again, a warm round of applause for our speaker today. And thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.